There are cases that arrive loudly, with sirens and flashing lights, and then there are cases that announce themselves through absence, through the sudden quiet left behind when a routine stops repeating. And it was that kind of silence that first pulled me in, because what began as a missing person report unfolded through ordinary details that refused to align. A bed that looked slept in, but a phone that went unanswered. A campus that kept moving, while one student did not. And as I reviewed the first statements and the early timelines, it became clear that the answers were not buried somewhere far away, but sitting inside the same walls where she had last been seen, held in place by people who spoke calmly while the facts bent under their words, until the record no longer supported the fire, the version of events they offered. And the absence stopped being passive and became deliberate, structured, and fatal, ending with the confirmed loss of a young woman whose name would only appear after everything else had already gone wrong, Alexis Crawford. I first came across the case through the initial missing person documentation, which was assembled quickly once it became clear that the student had not shown up for classes or responded to friends. And even at that early stage, the details suggested a life that was structured, predictable, and socially connected. Alexis Crawford was a senior at Clark Atlanta University, living off campus in an apartment she shared with another student. And by all accounts reviewed in the file, she maintained consistent routines that included classes, work, and regular communication with family and friends. Her disappearance was reported after friends noticed that she had not been seen or heard from in a way that was inconsistent with her habits. And when campus police and Atlanta Police Department officers began reviewing the last confirmed contacts, the timeline narrowed quickly. Alexis had last been seen returning to her apartment after spending time with friends, and there was no indication at that point that she planned to leave town, miss classes, or cut off communication voluntarily. I reviewed the statements from friends and family, and none suggested conflict, distress, or behavior that would indicate she was preparing to disappear, which placed immediate weight on the apartment itself as the last known location tied to her movements. That location was shared with her roommate, Baron Brantley, who was also a student, and his girlfriend, Jordan Atkins, who did not officially live there, but was present often enough to be considered part of the daily environment. Early interviews with Brantley and Atkins presented a narrative that appeared cooperative on the surface, with both acknowledging that Alexis had returned home and then later left after an argument, though the specifics of that argument were vague and changed subtly between accounts. As I reviewed the interview summaries, I noted that neither could clearly explain where she said she was going, how she intended to get there, or why she would leave without her phone, which was later found in the apartment. Those inconsistencies alone were not enough to establish wrongdoing, but they created friction with the known facts, particularly when combined with surveillance footage that failed to show Alexis leaving the apartment complex after her return that night. The absence of visual confirmation did not immediately prove she had not left, but it removed the strongest support for the version of events offered by the two people who had last seen her alive. As the search expanded, investigators canvassed the surrounding area, reviewed transit routes, and followed up on any digital trace that could confirm movement. Yet nothing surfaced to indicate that Alexis had traveled anywhere after returning home. Her bank accounts showed no activity, her phone remained inactive, and no friends reported seeing or hearing from her after that night. What stood out to me as I worked through the early case materials was how quickly the investigation narrowed without any dramatic revelation, simply through the methodical elimination of possibilities. Each path that would support a voluntary departure closed quietly, leaving behind a smaller and more troubling set of explanations that all pointed back to the apartment. The roommate relationship itself became a necessary focus, not because of any documented history of violence, but because proximity and access are facts that cannot be ignored when other explanations fail. Statements revealed that tensions had existed between Alexis and Jordan Atkins, particularly surrounding an alleged sexual assault incident involving Brantley, which Alexis had reported to campus authorities. That report was confirmed through university records, and it established a documented conflict that predated the disappearance. From an investigative standpoint, that disclosure mattered not as a motive in itself, but as a verified event that altered the dynamics inside the apartment, introducing stress, resentment, and risk into what had previously been a shared living space. The fact that the report existed meant that the people involved were navigating consequences that extended beyond personal relationships, including potential legal and institutional outcomes. By the time I reached the end of the initial review phase, Alexis Crawford was no longer simply missing, and the case had shifted toward determining what had happened inside that apartment, because every verified fact led back there, and nothing supported the idea that she had left it alive. The investigation entered its critical phase once law enforcement confronted the growing conflict between physical evidence and the accounts provided by the two individuals who remained inside the apartment after Alexis disappeared. I reviewed the supplemental interview reports that documented follow-up questioning, and it was clear that investigators were no longer testing possibilities, but pressing for reconciliation between statements and facts that refused to align. One of the most significant developments came from the examination of surveillance footage, which confirmed Alexis entering the apartment complex, but did not show her exiting at any point afterward. While cameras do not capture everything, the absence of any corroborating footage across multiple angles reduced the likelihood that she had left unnoticed, especially given the time frame in question. Digital forensics reinforced that conclusion, as Alexis's phone showed no outgoing communication after she returned home, and location data did not place her anywhere beyond the apartment. Her belongings remained behind, including items she would have taken if she intended to leave for any meaningful period. As pressure increased, inconsistencies in the statements from Brantley and Atkins became more pronounced, not through dramatic contradictions, but through subtle shifts in detail and suggested adaptation rather than recollection. Investigators documented changes in how the argument was described, when it occurred, and what Alexis allegedly said before leaving, and those changes were not supported by any external evidence. The turning point in the case occurred when Jordan Atkins agreed to provide a statement that departed from the earlier narrative, admitting that Alexis had not left the apartment and that she had been killed inside. According to the confession, Alexis was smothered during a confrontation, and the account placed both Brantley and Atkins at the scene during the act and its aftermath. I reviewed the confession transcript summaries with particular attention to what was included and what was not, noting that while the description acknowledged the act, it did not attempt to justify it through speculation or emotional framing, focusing instead on the sequence of actions as law enforcement required. That shift from denial to admission transformed the case from a search into a homicide investigation with identified suspects. Following the confession, Brantley was taken into custody, and further questioning led to additional confirmation of the events as described, including the disposal of Alexis's body in a wooded area in DeKalb County. The location was provided by the suspects and later confirmed by recovery teams. The recovery itself was conducted methodically, and the remains were located in an area consistent with the information provided, which strengthened the credibility of the confession and removed any remaining uncertainty about Alexis's fate. The medical examiner's findings confirmed that the cause of death aligned with the manner described, closing the gap between admission and forensic evidence. From an investigative perspective, there was no tape in the sense of a recorded crime, but there was a documented record, a chain of statements, surveillance reviews, and forensic confirmations that together formed an unbroken narrative supported by evidence rather than conjecture. Each piece reinforced the others, leaving little room for alternative explanations. What struck me most as I reviewed this phase of the case was how quickly the truth emerged once the factual framework became unavoidable. Not because of a single dramatic revelation, but because the cumulative weight of verified information eliminated the ability to maintain a false narrative. The apartment, once a shared living space, had become the center of a controlled environment where every movement, or lack thereof, was accounted for. By the time charges were formally filed, the investigation had established not only what happened, but who was responsible. Supported by confessions, physical evidence, and corroborated timelines, all of which met the standard required for prosecution. The final phase of my review focused on the legal outcomes and the documented consequences that followed the investigation, because in cases like this, resolution is measured not by emotion, but by record. Both Baron Brantley and Jordan Atkins were charged in connection with the murder of Alexis Crawford, with the charges reflecting their respective roles as established through evidence and admissions. Court records confirmed that Brantley pleaded guilty to felony murder and aggravated assault, resulting in a sentence of life in prison, with the possibility of parole, after serving the minimum required years under Georgia law. Atkins also pleaded guilty to felony murder, receiving a life sentence, with the possibility of parole, a resolution that closed the criminal proceedings without the need for a trial. The absence of a trial would not indicate uncertainty, but rather reflected the strength of the evidence, which made negotiated pleas a viable outcome for the prosecution and eliminated the need to present the case before a jury. From an official standpoint, the record was complete, with charges resolved and sentences imposed. University records documented the administrative response, including campus safety reviews and public statements acknowledging the loss, though those actions existed separately from the criminal process and did not alter the factual conclusions of the case. Alexis Crawford's death was recognized formally as a homicide, and the investigation was closed following sentencing. What remains in the file is a straightforward account, supported by evidence rather than interpretation, showing how a documented conflict escalated into a fatal act within a shared living space, and how that act was uncovered through routine investigative work rather than extraordinary measures. There were no hidden locations, no unknown suspects, and no unresolved questions left open by the record. For me, the case stands as a reminder of how quickly ordinary environments can become sites of irreversible harm, not through sudden chaos, but through moments that unfold behind closed doors, witnessed only by those involved and reconstructed later through facts that do not change once recorded. The official outcome is clear, the responsibility assigned, and the legal process concluded, leaving behind a complete factual account of the murder of Alexis Crawford, a college student whose life ended inside the place she called home.